It's Scott with you on Tuesday, February 17th, and I'll be reading from the Washington Examiner, the issue February 11th through the 18th of 2026. This is an article about national security entitled Trump's $1.5 trillion dream military budget proposal promises a golden fleet, a golden dome, and a host of bright, shiny new weapons. And the subheadline is, critics argue the notion of boosting defense spending by 50% in 1 year is loony. The author is Jamie McIntyre, who is the Washington Examiner's senior writer on national security. President Trump has a dream of a U.S. military, already the best trained and equipped fighting force on the planet, that is even mightier and more capable, with offensive weapons no one else has, along with an impenetrable missile shield that's the envy of the world, a golden dome. Thanks to a one-time infusion of $156 billion, spread out over 5 years, from Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, U.S. defense spending has topped $1 trillion annually for the first time in history. That easily maintains America's status as a bigger defense spender than the next nine countries combined, even taking into account that China keeps much of its military budget secret. But in Trump's worldview, in which the United States should always have the biggest and best of everything, his 250-foot proposed triumphal arch, which he wants to see on the banks of the Potomac, is so tall it would require approval from the Federal Aviation Administration, $1 trillion in defense is not enough. I've determined that for the good of our country, especially in these very troubled and dangerous times, our military budget for the year 2027 should not be $1 trillion, but rather $1.5 trillion, Trump posted on Truth Social in early January. This will allow us to build a dream military that we've long been entitled to and, more importantly, that will keep us safe and secure regardless of foe. Depending on which base number it is compared to, the $839 billion Pentagon top line just passed by Congress, the $900 billion in total defense spending, including other appropriations, or the $1 trillion figure that includes additional funds from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the one-year increase in defense spending is either 50%, 66%, or a whopping 78%. Nevertheless, the eye-popping was immediately endorsed by the Republican chairman of the House and Senate Armed Services Committees. Exactly the kind of investment it will take to rebuild our military, said Senator Roger Wicker, Republican from Mississippi, and Representative Mike Rogers, Republican from Alabama, in their joint statement. The previous administration resisted adequate military funding, instead settling for depleted stockpiles, aging equipment, and worsening recruitment challenges. The proposal also won plaudits from editorial pages as varied as the Wall Street Journal, which called the Trump proposal a serious defense budget at last, while noting a $1.5 trillion military will cost a lot less than a war with China. The new, more Trump-friendly Washington Post editorial page also was a fan, calling $1.5 trillion for defense a bargain, adding that while a 50% increase may sound outlandish at first, it is perhaps the most important step the White House can take to ensure peace through strength. If the president's proposal has one thing going for it, it is that, historically, U.S. military commanders have lamented that even as Pentagon budgets grew over the years, they did not keep up as a percentage of the nation's gross national product. A $1.5 trillion defense budget would also end the hypocrisy of the United States demanding that its poorer NATO allies spend 5% of GDP on defense, while the U.S. spends just over 3%. Trump's plan would put U.S. defense spending at 4.8%, which would move the U.S. from sixth place to first place among the 32 NATO allies, all of whom have pledged to meet that 5% target by 2035. Still, getting a $500 to $600 billion plus up in the Pentagon's top-line budget is going to be a heavy lift, even if Republicans hold on to the House and Senate after this year's midterm elections. So far, criticism from Democrats has been muted, largely because Trump has provided no details on how the money would be spent or how the Pentagon would handle such a large infusion of cash. Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, who has been barnstorming the country on what he calls his Arsenal of Freedom tour, has been telling defense industry leaders that the Pentagon will not waste a penny. "We're going to spend every dime of that wisely," Hegseth said recently in remarks at Lockheed Martin in Fort Worth, Texas. "We won't squander this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to rebuild our military," Hegseth said, standing alongside Elon Musk at the newly renamed Starbase, Texas. "Think of what this means as our efforts to transform the department come fully online," Hegseth said, calling the goal of a $1.5 trillion defense budget a historic and generational investment in American security. While defense contractors may be salivating, anticipating that untold billions will flow into Trump's pricey Golden Dome initiative, which is estimated at $175 billion to over $3 trillion in cost, some watchdog groups are warning that when too much money is sloshing around the Pentagon, a lot tends to spill over the sides. The notion of boosting defense spending by 50% in 1 year is loony. Even if you think it makes sense, the Pentagon lacks the capability to absorb such a tidal wave of cash so quickly. That's according to Mark Thompson, who's a blogger for the Project on Government Oversight. "It would be buying inefficiency, warping other elements of the U.S. economy, and fattening already corpulent defense contractor coffers," he said. 1 year into the Golden Dome project, the Pentagon has yet to spend any of the $23 billion appropriated by Congress last summer, according to Politico. Then, there's the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, which published an estimate of the compounding effect of spending $1.5 trillion in fiscal 2027 over subsequent defense budgets. Factoring in inflation, the result would be an increase in defense spending of about $5 trillion through 2035, while adding $5.8 trillion to the national debt. Trump insists the cost can easily be covered by the, quote, astronomical revenue that's coming in from tariffs. He told Fox Business anchor Maria Bartiromo in January that we'll be taking in over $600 billion this year alone. Noting that the Supreme Court is weighing whether Trump may have overstepped his tariff authority, the president added, "We hope we have a good decision from the Supreme Court. If we don't, we'll figure something else." Critics also are worried that billions may be wasted on grandiose projects that will take so long to complete that they'll likely become the latest in the long list of expensive Pentagon weapons programs that over the years have been canceled due to cost overruns, technical problems, or just because they no longer are suitable for modern warfare. Exhibit A is the Trump class of battleships, massive ships that would be bristling with a slew of exotic next-generation weapons, including rail guns, air defense lasers, and perhaps even nuclear-tipped cruise missiles. "We're bringing back the battleship," Trump said at a recent cabinet meeting, inspired, apparently, by a 1952 documentary series about World War II naval battles. He said, "Those unbelievable scenes that you see, in Victory at Sea, you'd see these incredible ships, and I thought they were powerful," Trump said. "But the battleships that we're building are going to be 100 times more powerful than those beautiful works of art." The battleship era ended decades ago, back in 1992, when the Navy decommissioned the USS Missouri, and there's a good reason the U.S. doesn't build battleships anymore. The operational concept that once justified battleships has now been obsolete for decades, supplanted first by aircraft carriers and now by long-range precision missiles and networked fleets, according to Trent Hone, who wrote in War on the Rocks. Building a modern battleship, he wrote, would produce a smaller, less resilient, and less lethal force than existing alternatives. In 1998, the Navy ditched a similar concept called the Arsenal ship, at that time citing the risk of carrying so many costly missiles in one surface ship. In an essay in Bloomberg, retired Admiral James Stavridis questioned the wisdom of putting so much expensive weaponry and so many sailors on a single, potentially vulnerable platform. He wrote that a better use of precious shipbuilding assets would be to construct many low-cost, unmanned, semi-submersible platforms. They could operate drone swarms launched from land or launch land attack missiles that would be controlled from space. President Trump wants 25 of the new big, beautiful battleships, as he's called them, to be the vanguard of what he's also now called the Golden Fleet. For now, and likely for years to come, however, it's just an artist's conception, and the betting among national security experts is that the program won't survive the next administration. This ship will never sail, wrote Mark Kancian, who's a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. It will take years to design, cost $9 billion each to build, and contravene the Navy's new concept of operations, which envisions distributed firepower. A future administration, he predicted, will cancel the program before the first of these ships ever hits the water. This article is headlined, "Proposed California Wealth Tax May Backfire on Liberal Politicians as the State's Revenue Base Dries Up." It's written by Dane Fitzgerald, who is a writer and podtuber in Diamond Springs, California, in the beautiful gold country of El Dorado County. The Golden State prides itself on its egalitarianism and willingness to make some of the rich in California squirm. This desire to take billionaires down a notch is evidenced by the so-called wealth tax that's currently generating debate among financial pundits and gathering signatures in an aggressive ground game before a November vote, if it makes the ballot. The wealth tax proposal has a strange side effect. It boosts the wealthiest cream of the crop and punishes those below them. After all, there's pride as well in being one of the special few who can manage to keep their heads above water in a political environment that punishes wealth creation. Take San Francisco. The city's population growth has been more or less flat over the last few decades, yet its wealth has positively exploded. Just spitballing, for every three slightly above-average citizen profiles the city bleeds, it gains one high-income, far above-average human capital powerhouse with an advanced degree. The 2026 so-called Billionaire Tax Act is billed as a one-time tax distillation of this same process. The rich, who can weather a levy on capital assets without missing a beat, as it applies to both their personal and business endeavors, will gain relative status over those who feel compelled to flee to a friendlier red state locale. While in absolute terms they've taken a financial hit, they can rest easy knowing that they've cleared the field of several elite peers and even industry competitors. As economist Robert H. Frank has noted, Charles Darwin has as much to teach us about economics as does Adam Smith. The elk with the larger antlers wins, with nary a care for any general condition of very large antlers on elks, or the elk equivalent of a pro-business regulatory and political environment. If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. There's a reason that phrase applies to business-unfriendly New York City and not Lubbock, Texas. In the second quarter of the 21st century, those words have found a second home in California's tech sector as well. NVIDIA's Jensen Huang, who sits at the helm of the most valuable company in the United States, is known for shrugging off this wealth tax proposal. He told Bloomberg in early January, "We chose to live in Silicon Valley, and whatever it takes, I guess, they would like to apply, so be it. I'm perfectly fine with it." Startup Y Combinator's Gary Tan and Sequoia's Michael Moritz have claimed that those not like Huang, who are billionaires mostly on paper via equity, would be hamstrung in a way not felt by those with more liquid wealth. It's akin to asking a middle-income household to dip into their IRA to cover expenses, while their neighbor has $100,000 in their checking account. Additionally, they've called out the unwise fragility of relying on approximately 200 billionaires to bail out the entire state. A state that feels the need to make such a move surely has foundational problems that are likely to create cracks once again, and there are only so many deep-pocketed contractors able to fill them in. Moritz warned that California's billionaire tax plan will backfire, writes Maud Hayter at Benzinga, noting that the state has become overly reliant on a few deep pockets over the past 50 years. Other notable opponents of the 2026 BTA include Oracle's Larry Ellison and Google's Larry Page. Both men are moving either residential or business assets out of the state. In the public sector, wealth tax opponents include Governor Gavin Newsom and a new entrant to the already crowded Democratic gubernatorial field trying to succeed him, San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan. Mahan said, "The unintended consequence is likely to be fewer high-paying tech jobs and less economic opportunity." As mayor of the city presiding over the original Silicon Valley, not the neo-Silicon Valley that wholeheartedly includes San Francisco, Mahan should know. To be fair, a major proponent of the bill, Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, also represents the heart of Silicon Valley. And while Khanna has dismissed concerns that the billionaire class is taking flight for redder pastures, indicators thus far, a la Ellison, Page, and White House artificial intelligence and crypto czar David Sacks, all of whom have already rented U-Hauls displaying Texan and Floridian art, suggest he's being too blasé on the matter. In December, more than 45 California LLCs associated with Page filed paperwork to move out of state or become inactive, according to Fox Business, and a trust with ties to him recently bought a $72 million home in Miami. NVIDIA's Huang believes the talent pool in Silicon Valley makes it imperative to remain in place, though with the rise of remote work, one wonders how long an in-person tech workforce will remain a compelling angle. Progressives' own logic of what motivates wealthy people to become wealthy in the first place suggests that they would, in fact, react negatively to an attempt to extract more of their resources. If greed, a desire to shape the world in their entrepreneurial image, and an insecure grasping hand are in play in the heads of the rich or rich adjacent, then dodging something like the BTA makes perfect sense. Of course, it's all relative. As Huang and evolutionary pressures show, treating a tax merely as the cost of doing business is both easier for the richest and helps raise the status of the same. Indeed, he has been cited by union interests promoting the BTA to make the case for its benefits. The NVIDIA CEO is, well, one of the good ones. That status, and if a competitor for that lucrative talent pool is encouraged to hit the road, it's all the better. Progressives are inadvertently advancing a culling mechanism that peels the almost top from the very top. Big tech, not unlike California's other cutthroat industry, Hollywood, is paradoxically expressive of Democrat-friendly sentiments and social stances at the same time they're almost totally unwelcoming of your average American plucked from a 7-Eleven. Meanwhile, the biggest employers in Oklahoma or any other conservative region merely need lots of warm bodies to keep the coffers happy. It's progressive Darwinism versus conservative open arms. If you can make it in Palo Alto, you can make it anywhere. This story is headlined, Trump signs minibus spending bill with $6.5 billion in earmarks. It's written by Kevin R. Kosar, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, who edits understandingcongress.org. President Trump recently signed $175 billion in spending legislation. The White House said little upon signing the Commerce, Justice, Science, Energy and Water Development and Interior and Environmental Appropriations Act of 2026. The move, however, signaled its support for Congress on the long-titled bill in a January 7th statement. The administration urges every member of Congress to support this fiscally responsible bill, which is a win for the American taxpayer, according to the White House. Trump's budget team highlighted the legislation's provisions to achieve energy dominance and to reduce violent crime, root out fraud in government programs, and address the past weaponization of the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Republican lawmakers claimed victory with the bill's enactment during a very low-key signing ceremony at the White House. This is another major win for the American people that implements the president's America First agenda, according to Representative Hal Rogers, a Republican from Kentucky, who added, "We're dismantling the drug trafficking networks that have tried to poison our communities for profit. And at the same time, we are reviving our coal communities and setting the stage for energy independence." Democrats also found a lot to like in the legislation. Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut, who is the ranking Democrat on the Appropriations Committee, said that the package makes meaningful investments to bring down costs for utility bills, and it provides substantial funding for clean energy. It makes our communities safer by increasing funding for violence against women and other public safety grants. The House passed the bill by a vote of 397-28, and the Senate passed it 82-15. Democrats supplied 206 votes in the House and 35 in the Senate. Left unmentioned in any of these cheerful official statements was that the minibus legislation carries 3,030 community project funding grants, also known as earmarks. That's according to the National Taxpayers Union. This may be a large reason why Democrats and Republicans were able to come together to support the bill. Many of the earmarks will fund infrastructure repair or replacement. The statute's Interior and Environment section has hundreds of line items for upgrading sewer lines and drinking water systems. Similarly, the Energy and Water Development will use federal funds for energy development projects and for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers projects to improve shipping ports and channels. The law's Commerce, Justice, Science section is a veritable smorgasbord of local projects. Funds will flow to universities for research on semiconductors, fentanyl detection inventions, and cancer cures. Local communities will receive dollars for things like crime prevention, which include new police vehicles, helicopters, and radios. In Florida, a Brevard County school will get $2 million to establish the Space Coast Junior-Senior High School's new Aviation Assembly and Fabrication Program, something that will give students hands-on training and preparing them for careers in the aerospace workforce, thanks to Representative Mike Haradopoulos, a Republican from Florida. Per tradition, Republicans, who hold the majority in both chambers, clearly brought home more of the bacon than Democrats did, although a final tabulation is not yet available. Not every earmark was partisan. Senators John Fetterman, Democrat from Pennsylvania, and David McCormick, Republican from Pennsylvania, partnered to secure earmarks to improve wastewater treatment and to mitigate flooding in their state. Members of the Appropriations Committees did especially well. Representative Chuck Fleischman, a Republican from Tennessee, who chairs the subcommittee that wrote the energy and water portion of the minibus, directed $213 million to upgrade the Chickamauga lock in his state. Senate Appropriations Committee Chairwoman Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington, secured $331.4 million in funds for infrastructure and natural resource restoration projects. The earmarks eruption came after Congress enacted hardly any of them for 2 years. Lawmakers' inability to pass annual funding bills in 2024 and last year necessitated enacting continuing resolutions, which typically don't include new directed spending requests like these. Congress brought back earmarks 5 years ago after a lengthy moratorium. New rules had been adopted in the early 2000s to prevent scandalous dealings, which sent one legislator, a few congressional staff members, and some lobbyists to prison. Community project grants, as earmarks are formally called, can no longer go to private corporations. All spending requests must be posted online by legislators, and the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, will audit some of those funded projects. Members of the House Freedom Caucus, which has regularly criticized earmarks, were among the few voices on Capitol Hill to actually criticize the spending. The continued inclusion of earmarks in appropriations bills is flatly unacceptable, according to Representative Eric Burleson, a Republican from Mississippi, who posted his comments on X. The federal government is drowning in debt, and Republicans should be leading the effort to reverse this culture, not accommodate it. But not all caucus members heaped scorn on earmarks. Republican Maryland Representative Andy Harris crowed over the projects he won for his district, including $40 million to acquire a vessel to dredge his state's eastern waterways. Capitol Hill seems unlikely to swear off earmarks anytime soon. Congress is attempting to enact another minibus spending bill that would fund the Labor, Health and Human Services, and Homeland Security departments, among others. It appears to carry 4,581 earmarks, which would amount to $7.8 billion in spending. These next three articles are written by Rob Crilly. He is the author of Washington Secrets. The first one is headlined, Trump approval rating bounces back after White House makes changes in immigration. President Donald Trump's approval ratings show signs of bouncing back after his administration changed its tack, softening tactics and replacing personnel overseeing immigration enforcement in the state of Minnesota. A new poll by Insider Advantage puts the president's approval rating back at 50%, which is where it was in December before two protesters were shot dead in Minneapolis. The conservative polling firm tends to produce numbers that are favorable to the Trump White House, but the trend is reflected in the Real Clear Politics average of polls, which has the approval rate ticking up by almost 0.75 points since its low 2 weeks ago. The numbers have been greeted with a sigh of relief inside the White House, where officials say it has illustrated how a course correction, shaking up enforcement personnel, had eased public concern. They had watched how immigration, once one of the president's most popular policies, had become a liability. A string of analysts suggested video of Border Patrol agents killing Alex Pretty, the second of two fatal shootings in Minneapolis, could mark a turning point, alienating voters who supported a border crackdown but who were horrified by the sight of masked agents on the streets of American cities. While other polling firms say the president's ratings could sink further as results from other surveys that launched in late January come in, Insider Advantage pollster Matt Towery said he was already seeing more positive results. He said, "In our latest round of polling, we've seen Trump's approval drop to a 43% immediately following the shooting and death of a man by ICE agents in Minnesota, only to rebound to the 50% level following a replacement of leadership of ICE efforts in that state. Gregory Bovino, the bullish commander-at-large of Border Patrol, had been replaced in Minneapolis by Tom Homan, who is Trump's border czar. Homan has long advocated a policy that targets violent immigrants with criminal backgrounds. And Homan declined to comment on the circumstances of the two shootings until investigations were completed. Unlike other officials who rushed to judgment and blamed the victims for their own deaths. Pollster Towery said his poll marked a shift back and forth within the same margins as the last presidential election. Certain issues arise and his numbers fall slightly, then other events take place and he returns to higher numbers, Towery said, although he did warn that Republican outlook for the midterm elections remained, quote, dicey. The survey of 1,000 likely voters has a margin of error of plus or minus 3 percentage points. At the White House, spokeswoman Taylor Rogers welcomed the numbers. The president has the greatest instincts in American politics, which is why he reset the mainstream media's narrative to focus on the administration's common sense policies to keep American people safe, she told us. President Trump wants to remove violent illegal alien criminals while elected Democrat officials fight to protect them. We know who Americans are going to side with, she added. Two other polls show the possible danger for Trump. An Ipsos poll published on February 2nd shows that 62% of people believe that ICE officers have gone too far. And a poll from the Pew Research Center found that 54% of the public believes that it is unacceptable for agents to arrest U.S. citizens who help others avoid immigration enforcement. This story is headlined, How 6 inches of Snow Cost Washington $100 Million. The snow and ice were still piled up in streets and sidewalks some 11 days after the nation's capital was brought to a halt by wintry weather. At the same time, the economic fallout is just becoming clear. An analysis by Steward Red Queen estimates that about 40% of Washington's 400,000-strong workforce was simply unable to work for 3 days at the end of January. The restaurant sector saw sales drop 85% during that time. Once those numbers are plugged into a financial model that accounts for indirect impact, the total cost of the snowstorm comes in at $80 to $100 million. That works out at 12 times the budget that's been allocated for snow removal in the district. Anyone stuck at home, unable to work, or sick of tramping through iced-up crosswalks or flummoxed by gridlocked streets would agree with the conclusions of the analysis, which are, the city would be much better allocating more money to snow removal contingencies. Finally, Trump supporters take on Springsteen in the charts. One of MAGA's biggest musical stars is coming for Bruce Springsteen. Streets of Minneapolis, Springsteen's anti-ICE protest song, charted at number one on Billboard's digital song sales chart earlier this month. Now, Natasha Owens, who is known for her brand of Christian worship songs and praise for President Trump, has recorded a song entitled The Boss in response. I was born in the USA, and I used to be a fan, runs her lyric, all delivered above the sort of thumping beat found on big Springsteen songs. You preach from your mansion, and you've lost that human touch. Her most recent single was entitled The Somali Waltz, about fraud in Minnesota. Bruce Springsteen is an iconic artist and prolific songwriter who's been the voice of Americans for generations, she told Secrets, adding, My song, The Boss, had to be written for all his fans who are heartbroken. This story is entitled, Trump's new Fed chairman pick keeps monetary analysts guessing on planned interest rate and other inflation moves should the Senate confirm him. It's written by Zach Halashak, who is the economics reporter for The Washington Examiner. President Trump has pummeled Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell for years now over interest rate policy. But in just mere months, Powell's term will be up, and former Fed Governor Kevin Warsh has been nominated by Trump to succeed Powell as the central bank's top official. Here's what to expect. Powell, who is 73 years old, is set to depart as Fed chairman in May, though he does have the option to remain on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors until the end of January of 2028. That move would no doubt anger Trump, who chose Powell as Fed chairman during his first White House term. The president announced last month that he had chosen Warsh, who is 55 years old, to be the next Fed chairman over National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett. That pick came as a surprise to some, given that Hassett had been seen as the frontrunner for the job for some time. Trump has been hounding Powell and the Fed to cut interest rates more aggressively since he started his second term. That push for lower interest rates was undoubtedly a top agenda item in interviews that Trump conducted for the role. But the pick also comes at a time when Fed independence is being closely scrutinized. Last month, Powell announced that the Justice Department was investigating him and that the central bank recently received grand jury subpoenas related to testimony that he gave to the Senate last year about renovation cost overruns at the Fed's headquarters in Washington. Powell tied the blame squarely to Trump's crusade for lower rates and said the inquiry was simply a pretext to pressure him on monetary policy. The extraordinary accusation sparked some concern even from congressional Republicans, like retiring Senator Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina, who's a member of the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. Tillis threatened to block any of Trump's Fed nominees until the legal matter is concluded. He reiterated that the threat still holds after Warsh's nomination, but called Warsh a qualified nominee with a deep understanding of monetary policy. So who is Warsh? He's got experience at the Fed, but is a bit of an outsider in the sense that he has not been a public policymaker now for over a decade. Still, the Stanford and Harvard Law School graduate was a member of the Federal Reserve Board during the Great Recession and has long been a prominent figure in finance and economics. President George W. Bush nominated Warsh, a one-time Morgan Stanley banker, to the Fed board in 2006, and Warsh held that role under both Bush and President Barack Obama. After leaving the central bank, Warsh worked as a distinguished visiting fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He was also a partner at billionaire Stanley Druckenmiller's Duquesne Family Office, which has lent some credibility to his pick in the markets. That's according to Jonathan Birx, who is Executive Vice President of Economic and Health Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Birx said, "He's been a real market participant in a way that gives him that just the inherent trust and recognition from folks that he's going to be attentive to concerns coming out of the markets and coming out of the economy." Birx has known Warsh since they worked together in the Bush White House nearly a quarter century ago. Between 2002 and 2006, Warsh was special assistant to the president for economic policy and also executive secretary of the National Economic Council. Warsh has faced criticism for his handling of the 2008 financial crisis and its fallout. At that time, the Fed took extraordinary measures to intervene in the economy and prop up markets. Unemployment was spiraling, and then Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke spearheaded looser money policy that Warsh, at the time, panned as being potentially inflationary. Unlike Hassett, who has been somewhat of the economic spokesman for Trump's administration in recent months, Warsh is a little bit more of an unknown when it comes to monetary policy. When he was back at the Fed earlier in his career, Warsh developed a reputation as something of an inflation hawk, meaning he was seen as more hesitant about looser money policies and more concerned with rising prices. That's notable because inflation is still running above the Fed's 2% goal. The key question is what Warsh will signal or push for on interest rate policy, should he be confirmed by the Senate. His nomination hearings will be very closely scrutinized, and he will certainly face questions on where he thinks interest rates should be. Despite his past hawkishness, last year Warsh dinged the Fed for what he called its hesitancy to cut interest rates. He has notably criticized the Fed for the size of its footprint on the economy and called for shrinking the central bank's multi-trillion dollar balance sheet. He has also made a lot of comments about wanting to reduce the Fed balance sheet, wanting to have the Fed pull back from some of the roles that it's played in terms of providing liquidity to the market for being a backstop for what some of the banking system and whatnot, according to Stephen Cates, who's a financial analyst at Bankrate. He said that doing so might be challenging, given that there have been multiple rounds of quantitative easing since the financial crisis nearly two decades ago now. What Warsh has said, in a way, is that he thinks we can have lower interest rates, but at the same time not let conditions get too easy in the market by reducing the Fed balance sheet, Cates added. I think that's going to be easier said than done. But don't expect immediate rate cuts or anything dramatic right out of the gate. That's because while the Fed chairman may lead the Fed board and messaging, interest rate decisions are made by a 12-person board called the Federal Open Market Committee. Cates explained that anybody who's saying we're going to get a 50 basis point cut right off the bat in that June meeting is dreaming. Burks said that Warsh has always been very data-driven and will be attentive to what the numbers are saying. He added, there's been a lot made recently of the fact that Warsh was more hawkish earlier in his career and that recently he's been somewhat more dovish. And I think in both cases, Burks said, they're driven by his interpretation of data. I think he'll be open about what are the puts and takes that is being considered in leading policy, he added. Steve Kamen, who was a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a former Federal Reserve official, said that Warsh may also argue that the proliferation of artificial intelligence will lead to a productivity boom that would allow for lower interest rates. Stephen Moore has advised Trump and is chairman and a co-founder of the group Unleash Prosperity, which supports free markets, repealing regulations, and more. He said he hopes that the Fed, under Warsh, will prioritize maintaining dollar dominance. The dollar has seen notable declines over the past year or so. The most important thing here is to make sure that the dollar retains its world reserve currency status. I don't think that we're going to lose that, but that's just so critical to the well-being of the United States, Moore said in an interview with the Examiner. Fed independence is a major concern for Trump's critics as we pass the one-year mark in the second year of Trump's second term. Some hope that Warsh will ensure that the central bank is insulated from what many perceive as undue influence coming from the White House. While Warsh would face many questions about monetary policy and interest rates at his confirmation hearing, senators are also expected to press him about Fed independence, along with what Democrats and some Republicans see as the Trump administration pushing against this too much. Still, Kamen pointed out that there is a major question mark over the confirmation process, given Tillis's promise to block any Fed nominees that Trump nominated, contingent on the investigation into Powell. Before the Warsh pick, some Fed watchers were concerned that Hassett could have been more of a yes man for the administration. So, the Warsh choice might also make confirmation easier, particularly in light of the ongoing Powell investigation. I think the general public doesn't focus on this, but the ability to get confirmed is something that the White House has to be thinking about very carefully, said Dennis Lockhart, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, who worked with Warsh for several years at the Fed. He added, Warsh is probably an easier path to confirmation. This is a column from Tiana Lowe Descher, who is an economics columnist for The Examiner. It's headlined, The Real Population Bomb to Come, Social Security's Looming Bankruptcy. Throughout President Trump's second non-consecutive term, pundits across the political spectrum have been warning that the economy is on the cusp of mass job losses. They have cited everything from demonstrable downward pressure on the labor market, from tariffs to Trump's orders for the Federal Reserve, an independent body, to immediately slash the federal funds rate. But as our nation hits a dangerous economic inflection point, its long-predicted future demographic crisis will not be that we have too many people for too few jobs, as is often warned about, but instead, too few people will be available to work at all. Democrats like to blame the nation's demographic decline on Trump's immigration policy. But so long as the White House remains focused on deporting illegal immigrants, especially with an emphasis on the criminal illegal immigrants and welfare queens who are overwhelmingly a net negative on Uncle Sam's balance sheet, the enforcement of already extant immigration law is not the problem. Over the year starting July 1st, 2024, the United States Census Bureau found that the nation's population only increased by 1.8 million people. That's about half of 1%. That is about half as fast as it averaged 20 years ago. The core cause is, and always has been, the birth dearth of the last decade. That birth dearth is a consequence of collapsing marriage rates. While fertility among married women has held roughly constant over the last three decades, it has fallen off among unmarried women. And because fewer young people are getting married, the overall fertility rate has crumbled. This means that whereas the annual rate of the population's natural increase due to births minus deaths was steady from the end of the baby boom until the 21st century, it began a precipitous decline at around the time of the Great Recession. Now, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that American deaths will outpace American births by 2030, which means that, absent immigration, the population will begin to shrink in 4 years. Even accounting for the CBO's immigration assumptions, which lie somewhere in the average between former President Joe Biden's open borders and White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy Stephen Miller's dream to obliterate legal immigration, the number of seniors age 65 or older is slated to go up an average 1.6% per year for the next decade, while the number of people younger than 25 years old will decrease by just under 1% annually. In other words, we have an increasing rate of retirees aging into socialized health care and worker-funded welfare, but a diminishing rate of young people being born and raised into the labor force. Officially, Social Security's old age and survivors insurance program is not supposed to reach insolvency until the end of 2032, at which point beneficiaries will face an automatic average benefit cut of 24%. Congress will try to kick that can down the road by raiding the Disability Insurance Trust Fund, but even that would only buy the retirement program another 2 years before reaching insolvency at the start of 2034, and then would necessitate a 26% benefit cut. Social Security is not going broke because Congress broke into some non-existent lockbox. Rather, the program was always designed as something of a Ponzi scheme. This was fine in 1940, when 159 workers only had to shave pennies off their paychecks to fund one beneficiary. It was even theoretically okay when over three workers funded each beneficiary from the 1970s through the start of this century. It's become a catastrophe, however, as the birth rate has collapsed over the last two decades. The only bit of good news is that even though Congress and the rest of the gerontocracy have deluded themselves into believing that Social Security can in fact be saved, when it comes to this matter, the children are actually all right. Last December, a poll from the Cato Institute, conducted by YouGov, found that only one-third of Generation Z believed Social Security would still exist when they retire. And, wisely, those under the age of 30 seemed keen to let the program put itself out of its misery rather than further indebted the nation to save it. Nearly half of Gen Z supported immediately cutting Social Security to fund the chasm that will come with insolvency in 6 years, and 60% opposed raising payroll taxes to maintain scheduled benefits, which more under 30-year-olds agreed with only because it is really just a nicer way of saying the same thing. The wealthiest generation created a federal deficit designed to compound its liabilities on autopilot, and it left it to the smallest generation in a century. The real population bomb was never the non-existent risk of too many people, but rather a lonely labor force burdened with a federal balance sheet that they will never be able to repay. The story is entitled The Right Balance in Higher Education by James Pearson and Naomi Schaefer Riley. They are senior fellows, Pearson at the Manhattan Institute and Schaefer Riley at the American Enterprise Institute. Many people across the political spectrum were alarmed when they learned administrators at Texas A&M had prevented a philosophy professor from teaching the works of Plato because it violated legislative regulations designed to eliminate woke curricula in the state's institution of higher learning. Many conservatives, while generally sympathetic to efforts to eliminate left-wing indoctrination in college and university curricula, agree that legislative interventions of this kind can blur lines between reasonable guidelines that are designed to eliminate indoctrination and outright censorship. This episode and others like it suggest that recent attempts by conservatives to push back on academic indoctrination haven't been as well thought out as some may have hoped. According to a report from PEN America, lawmakers in 15 states have passed 21 bills designed to regulate or even censor courses that are taught at public colleges and universities. Censorship now, sadly, is an intractable reality on college and university campuses, said Amy Reed, program director of Freedom to Learn at PEN America. But PEN America is guilty of throwing many different kinds of initiatives into the same censorship basket. Some of these interventions, legislatively, may have reached inappropriately into the kinds of books or subjects that can be taught in the classroom. But others banned diversity, equity, and inclusion programs or required a degree of intellectual diversity in campus hiring. That's not censorship, but a reasonable step to push back on DEI censorship and propaganda in higher education. It's difficult, in higher education in particular, for lawmakers to control academic curricula while maintaining a veneer of academic freedom. Unlike with fourth graders, we expect and hope that college students can read from a variety of texts while thinking critically about themes and messages those books contain. Whether they assign Plato, Nietzsche, the Bible, or even the deservedly maligned 1619 Project, professors should have latitude in assigning works they believe will introduce students to different approaches to human nature and the world in which they live. Conservative-leaning professors have always taught students about Marxism, communism, feminism, and other controversial subjects. Have they occasionally added William F. Buckley? Are they more likely to include Edmund Burke? Perhaps. But conservatives have rarely tried to propagandize students in regard to their point of view in the way that leftist academics have promoted their ideological doctrines in writings, lectures, and classroom presentations. It's one thing to read Marx, Freud, or Marcuse, quite another to present them as exemplars of true doctrine. Moreover, nearly every radical idea taught in so-called woke programs can be traced back to the writings of some dead white male that conservatives have been criticized for presenting in their own courses. But the real problem in higher education is so deeply rooted as to defy reasonable efforts to reform it. Over the past several decades, colleges and universities have organized themselves around a dubious ideological doctrine, In this case, the so-called diversity ideology, which asserts that some groups have been oppressed throughout American history, other groups have oppressed them, and it's the task of higher education to redress those injustices. This is a comprehensive doctrine that controls teaching, curricula, appointments, and promotions at nearly every college and university in the country, and has done so for the past 4 or 5 decades. The oppressed are favored groups like blacks, Hispanics, feminists, immigrants, environmentalists. The oppressors are white people, mostly white men. By some coincidence, the oppressed groups are also key constituent groups of the Democratic Party. The diversity doctrine also controls the delegate selection process for the party's national conventions. It also links higher ed to one of the major political parties, contributing to the politicization of colleges and universities. Many thoughtful people wonder why college faculty and administrative leaders are almost completely made up of liberals, leftists, and Democrats, while conservatives are hard to find on any college campus. This has occurred more or less by political design over many years and under pressure from the federal government and groups organized to promote the diversity ideology. Conservatives aren't welcome on college campuses because they don't accept the diversity ideology. Conservatives are as unwelcome on a college campus as a free market economist in a socialist party. This happens not because professors teach the wrong books, though one could note that some books are more worthwhile than others, but because the diversity ideology is now the guiding force throughout the contemporary university. Efforts to reform these institutions will have to find ways to detach them from the diversity ideology. At Harvey Mansfield's first meeting of a class on manliness a few decades ago, several rabid feminists showed up ready for a fight. But they were baffled when he began the course with a discussion of how Aristotle understood courage. He may not have turned them into followers of the ancient philosopher, but that wasn't the point. I'm Scott. It's been a pleasure being with you today. Hopefully we can talk again soon.